This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. The We Love Chattanooga auction begins tomorrow and runs through May 12th. The auction is an online storefront that will raise money for people and businesses here in Hamilton County impacted by COVID-19 and the recent tornadoes. Gift cards, goods, and services will be auctioned and sold. Businesses are free to participate, and those that do will receive all of the proceeds. Anyone can buy or bid on an item, as well as donate to the United Way of Greater Chattanooga's Restore Hope Fund for COVID-19 relief. Marissa Bell is with the Chattanooga Tourism Company, which is launching the auction along with River City Company.
Marissa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ray.
Tell us more about this auction. Given the times, this is an online storefront instead of an in-person event.
Yes, and it is an opportunity for people in Chattanooga and visitors, potential visitors, people who've been here before to Chattanooga, to get a piece of Chattanooga while a lot of us are staying at home and we can't go see the places that we like to go to usually. We can't dine in the restaurants inside like we normally like to, so even see our favorite artist. So this is an opportunity to get a little bit of Chattanooga while we're staying at home and hold on to those memories, and then also to support businesses that are really feeling the pain right now of having to change the way they do business. Also the tornadoes here that impacted a lot of businesses.
And when we say piece of Chattanooga, what are we talking about?
There are things being added all the time, but tomorrow when we go live, you'll see dozens of different items from artists. So you could get artwork, you could get some custom cards that have Chattanooga imagery on them by local artists. You could get a gift card to a local restaurant, or you could get a photography package with a local photographer. So all sorts of different things, from restaurants to hotels to attractions, and then our different artisans here that are selling their goods and services on this platform.
Now, this is running from tomorrow through May 12th, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So 12 days to pick some of your favorite items, or maybe find a new business in Chattanooga that you like what they are putting out and you want to get involved supporting them.
Why 12 days? Because we like the sound of 12 days from other contexts?
Yeah, so it gives us a little bit more than a week, which I think is a great stretch for people to get interested in an item and then make a decision around making a purchase.
And proceeds from this, as you say, will be supporting businesses impacted by COVID-19 and the tornadoes. What are you hearing from these businesses at this time? We read day after day about the economic impact of this. What are you hearing from these businesses?
So we know a lot of businesses in Chattanooga are related to the tourism and hospitality industry. About a third of businesses in the Chattanooga area are related in some way, whether they're a restaurant or arts and entertainment or accommodations or one of our attractions. So we know that for some of them, they've been closed for several weeks because sometimes it's not possible to practice those social distancing guidelines in a place that might have a big crowd. And then for others, like restaurants, they've had to modify the way they do business with doing takeout, or some of them it's not been viable to do that. So they haven't had that revenue for several weeks. So we know that they are definitely taking a hit, and we want to provide a way that can help support them with some funds during this financial impact time.
And also to send a message, business is still out there.
Yes, and we at the Chattanooga Tourism Company shifted our entire outlook and focus as the pandemic really was here in Chattanooga and shelter-in-place mandates were put in place. We focused on the community in Chattanooga, understanding that our local businesses really are going to be impacted, and to see what we could do week by week to really support them. So we are trying to do that with this, providing some supplemental funds because we know that they are missing out on some income during this time.
And this, of course, is a 12-day effort, but it's no doubt the first of several efforts, not just by you folks, but others, whether it's helping businesses or helping feed people or what have you.
Absolutely. We partnered with the River City Company on this, and I know that they've been doing a lot of work downtown to support different restaurants with getting the word out about the different services they're offering. And the Chattanooga Chamber has also been a partner throughout this, looking to support businesses in Hamilton County that are needing services and resources during this time.
And Marissa, where can people go online starting tomorrow to participate, to follow?
So starting tomorrow, go bid and buy on your favorite items from your Chattanooga businesses, and you'll go to visitchattanooga.com/auction.
All right, Marissa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Southern Champion Tray is one of Chattanooga's oldest manufacturers, around for nearly a century. During this pandemic, the maker of food trays and paperboard packaging has shifted some of its operations to produce disposable face shields. The company has been donating the shields to healthcare providers and first responders, but it's also ramping up to sell them to businesses that need them. David Chapman is a structural engineer at SCT who worked on the design.
David, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Ray. It's good to be here.
Describe the design of this face shield.
This face shield, it's a two-piece unit. It starts with a headband. It's much like an old school Burger King birthday crown that you used to get. And then the second part is just a large window that securely locks into the temples of the headband. Pretty simple.
And one thing that you were concerned about in designing this was making sure that there was a wide field of vision.
That's true, and actually it was more the concern of the doctors and nurses that I was developing this with. In the early stages, I realized that no matter what it is that I come up with, I have to make sure that it's useful. So I need to reach out to these people, and through some friends on Facebook and Instagram, I got connected to half a dozen doctors and nurses, and they kind of became my review board as I was designing this thing. They told me what was working, what wasn't. And they're the ones who actually said, I need a wide field of view. One of them said, if we're crowded around a patient trying to save them, I need to be able to see who's standing next to me.
And how long did this consulting take, and how far and wide did you consult?
See, I think the consulting probably started late March. I think probably middle of the week, maybe about the 26th, by the 30th, 31st. I remember I sent out a picture to my review board and on that morning and said, this is the design that I've come up with last night. I'd like to talk to you later tonight about it. Let me know if we can schedule something. And it just took off like a rocket. By the middle of the day, several of the doctors were asking if they could get samples so that they could show other people. By the end of the day, I was getting orders from as far as Kentucky, which was incredible because we hadn't even talked tooling yet. Barely anybody in the company knew that I had a design yet. It really was lightning in a bottle.
You mentioned tooling. What challenges have you and the company faced in adjusting your operation to be able to produce these shields?
What we make on a daily basis is donut boxes, to-go boxes. A large part of it is food trays like you would get at a ball game or a food truck. Last year, we made over 1 billion of those food trays. But it was interesting to drop everything and start making the face shields once everybody realized, oh, we have a thing that we can make that can contribute, that can help. We were able to go from concept to our first production run in a little over a week. It was very impressive. I wanted to run down and give everybody a hug, but that's not something we do anymore in this age. But yeah, it was truly surprising how quickly we were able to retool and start pumping these out.
These are being donated, but you're also taking orders.
That is correct. We joined a coalition of other packaging companies to commit to donating 100,000 in our own areas. I think as of right now, we've donated 75,000 already. But yes, we do plan to sell some to anybody that needs it outside of the area.
And what are you hearing from companies like yours elsewhere in the country, elsewhere around the world that are collaborating, producing face shields?
I think we all realize that there's an opportunity that as manufacturers, there's a way that we can help. So many people I've talked to and about the face shield, you can see it's almost a physical change when they realize, oh, there's something I can do about this. Instead of just waiting to get sick, I can take action. I can do something to help my community. And everybody on our industry is jumping into that. We're just all trying to figure out what's our part to play in trying to help humanity.
And if people want to contact you, contact the company, what's the best way to do it?
We have gotten interest in the face shield all over the planet as far as Melbourne, Australia. We are trying to funnel all of our interest into an email address, facetshield@sctray.com. So please don't call me anymore. I've gotten so many phone calls, and I tell people, I couldn't sell you anything if I wanted to. I'm not that part of the system. Please go to the email address.
You handle the design part.
Yeah. I'm the design guy. I'm not a sales guy. I'm not the production guy. I made the thing, and now I'm handing it off to someone else.
And even though you've handed off the design to your colleagues, you still have a lot of work to do.
Oh, absolutely. I've been walking around checking with each department saying, if there's anything I can do on a design level to make this run faster, make this run easier, if there's anything I can get for you, beg, borrow, steal, let me know, I'll do it. The sense of urgency of getting the product out there to the people who need it, it's so heavy on top of us right now. Everyone feels it, but it's a good way. For so long, you know, everyone's just kind of saying, when is coronavirus going to hit Chattanooga? When are we all going to get sick? But now it's more of, okay, when are we going to put out the next batch of the Space Shield? When are we going to be able to get it into the next hospital? The urgency is still there. It's just channeled in a different way.
All right. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nonprofits in the Chattanooga area are banding together to support each other during the pandemic and its aftermath. Kim Schumpert is executive director of the Chattanooga Women's Leadership Institute and liaison to the recently formed Chattanooga Nonprofit Alliance.
Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be with you today.
Tell us about the Nonprofit Alliance.
March 13th was a very interesting day for all of us, but particularly for the nonprofit sector. As we sort of retreated to our homes, we quickly discovered that relief was going to be on the forefront of everyone's mind, as it rightly should be. But sort of immediately, there were a group of us who said, wait a second, we're not on the front lines as people would generally consider nonprofits to be. So we weren't necessarily feeding people, we weren't clothing, you know, we weren't doing some of the more emergency sort of first responder services. And pretty quickly, we recognized the threat, if you will, for sort of a sector collapse if we didn't begin to think strategically pretty early on. And so the alliance formed out of a need to just really make sure that we were on our A game. Those of us who are in this sector and do fundraising for a living understand how long it takes to raise a dollar. Those are dollars that are based very strongly in relationships that have expanded years. And a lot of those dollars were suddenly going to be diverted to this massive relief effort that we really weren't sure how was going to play out. Pretty quickly, out of the gate, there were about 55 organizations who came together. There's a steering committee of some of us who are connected in the community pretty cross-sectionally. That includes United Way, that includes the Association of Fundraising Professionals, Chattanooga Women's Leadership Institute, First Things First, Girls Inc., Arts Build, and those are just to name a few, the Community Foundation. So you can see that there was a cross-section of our community that was represented, Thrive Regional Partnerships. And that was intentional because we knew that we had the ability to sort of advocate for what efforts around relief, recovery, and rebuilding were going to look like, because we're in the long game business. We have to think strategically all the time about what happens if a portion of our funding has gone away. The real threat, though, is that for years, for decades, nonprofits have been rewarded for not having reserves, as the name suggests, not for profits. When we write a grant, for example, we're often asked, you know, how much of this is going to go towards overhead or towards general operational funds? And typically, funders don't like that to be more than 10% of the entire budget of the grant, which means that there are goals and objectives that are tied to the remaining 90%. Well, if your programming suddenly disappears, then you suddenly can't fulfill that 90% obligation. So what does that look like in a time of crisis where you have to completely shut down doing the things that you're doing? And so we began to look at this as more of a sector problem. If you think about your own personal interface with a nonprofit, you typically probably only interface with maybe two or three nonprofits at a time. But as an entire sector, For example, we had a survey. So far, about 61 participants, different organizations, have responded to that survey. And across only 61 nonprofits, we have uncovered more than 2,600 employees affected by this crisis. So that's kind of where the need came about, is pretty quickly we surveyed the landscape and we thought, uh-oh, if we resource only a handful of organizations because they happen to be on the front lines, we happen to be emotionally tied to the work that they're doing, the opportunity exists for them to have been resourced inequitably compared to the entire sector. And now we've got a sector collapse, which becomes an economic problem.
It's not about taking away from the people in the nonprofit sector who are on the front lines. It is about protecting the rest of the sector that most people might not realize are nonprofits doing what they do in civil society.
That's exactly right. And to be fair, many of the frontline nonprofits will be able to access funds that other nonprofits won't. For example, you know, a food bank would be able to access funds other than just the PPP. So there will be emergency funding available in other sources. And so we just want to make sure that some of the, you know, if you think about sort of what has happened with PPP and how many large businesses have absorbed the initial $350 billion, well, the same principle applies with smaller nonprofits. We just simply don't have the capacity individually, like small businesses, to be on the front lines of receipt of those funds. So there has to be some safeguard in place to ensure that we don't continue to inequitably distribute what's available. And that's not to say that those organizations don't need those funds, and they absolutely do. It's just somebody has to be able to ascertain what are the various resources, what constitutes what we call kind of an at-risk nonprofit. So is there a runway 6 months? Is it 2 months? The statistics would tell us, the national data would tell us, that a nonprofit typically has 1 to 2 months worth of reserves, which would tell you that smaller nonprofits are really probably eating into that at this point already. We're just trying to make sure that we're thinking about the full picture.
That timeline parallels what we've been told about how much runway a small business has.
Very similar. And I will say we mimic what's happening in the small business sector very closely. And a lot of the insight and a lot of the information that they receive is what we are relying on as well. The added step that nonprofits have to take, though, is we have to just first discover, are we even included in small business funding? So sometimes we are, sometimes we aren't. Traditionally, nonprofits are really not included in SBA loans, for example. And so some of the money that came out of the city of Chattanooga, we had to sort of take that extra step to research and say, this sounds great, are nonprofits included? And so somebody has to be that gatekeeper of information to figure out, okay, does this apply to our sector at all even? So there is an added stressor to our sector because of some of those nuances.
You talk about the Alliance as being a gatekeeper of information for nonprofits. You're out there spreading awareness. It's very early days and things are evolving hour by hour, day by day. But when it comes to shoring up the nonprofit sector beyond those groups on the front lines, what kind of tools are we talking about here?
We have three main goals. And right now, our three main goals are advocacy, information dissemination, and recovery fundraising in whatever form that can take. We don't necessarily feel like we have to raise the funds, but we do have to advocate for whatever funds being raised being directed and allocated and appropriated appropriately. And so that's kind of our position right now. We're trying to determine what that can look like. Again, we're working with the funding community to see what capacity is there without creating too much donor fatigue. We do recognize that they appreciate that there is an alliance that they can work with to get information out. Otherwise, they tend to get overwhelmed by individual requests that are, yes, very needed and very responsive to the emergency, but are also a little bit tone deaf in regards to where those funders stand with funding other opportunities at this moment. And so we're really trying to sort of be a voice there to balance some of that conversation and to put representatives in the right places to advance this message at the right time, place, and manner. We're not sure what the future holds right now. To be perfectly honest, we're not sure where the opportunities are going to come from. We know that if we continue to build on the relationships that we have, that it will be okay, but it may look very different. You may see fewer fundraisers, for example. particularly if we can't even convene more than a few people at a time. So fundraising is going to have to look different. We're going to have to advocate to the public to continue to support nonprofits, either as a collective or individually. There will be those people who don't want to give through an alliance and who want to just resource the nonprofit that they've worked with forever. We're not advocating against that in any shape, form, or fashion. But if we can build something that presents us as a collective and particularly as a major employer, then hopefully that's going to attract some different sources. So, for example, we just sent some information up to the state of Tennessee. We're working on that right now because they're convening a group as an advisory committee to the governor. And so we're hopeful that we can help shape the lens that all of that is viewed through so that maybe the state can come in. Maybe we can redirect funds from the city, for example. Are there CDBG funds? Are there, which are block grant type funds that are typically more restrictive? Can we open those up to be less restrictive? Can we open general improvement funds from legislators, for example? So there are a number of options that we are exploring right now. The first is going to be an awareness campaign like we're doing right now to try to just help people understand that we don't want to have to sacrifice our quality of life unnecessarily because we weren't strategic right now.
Where can people go online for more information?
So they can reach out to us on Facebook. We have Chattanooga Nonprofit Alliance COVID-19 resource there. Right now it's a very grassroots establishment organization. My email at my place of employment is kim@cwli.org. People can reach out to me directly. And we also have a shared drive where we have just a ton of information. So from day one, we have been working with the Chamber of Commerce is another partner of ours. They keep us updated on all the policy shifts and anything that we get, we upload into that shared drive. So we've got a huge database of resources.
All right, Kim, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. You may be wondering this, especially after this past week. How does local government work, both here in the city of Chattanooga and in Hamilton County? Liz Norell is a political science professor at Chattanooga State Community College. On Saturday, she'll be teaching a course on local government online at thechattery.org. That's where you'll also find her teaching a course on Tennessee state government on Sunday, May 10th.
Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
The courses that you're offering online through the Chattery, the civics courses, they are timelier than ever, given what we're seeing in the headlines here in the Chattanooga area, in Tennessee, Georgia, and beyond.
Absolutely. I will say that I've been teaching a basic course on American government for about 15 years. And in the last, four years, my students have been more interested in what I have to say than ever before in my career, and especially right now.
How much in your teaching have you found a gap in your students' grasp of civics? That's something that has been written about a lot in the past few years.
Yeah, you know, my students come to me, at Tennessee at least, they're required to take a course on government in high school. But what I've found is that they come into my class expecting that they are going to know everything we talk about. And then when we talk about the practical parts of how do you participate in government, how do you engage in becoming an active part of your community, they have almost no information. I think a lot of what they're learning in high school is kind of the ideal, the textbook description of how things work, but it doesn't go very deep and it doesn't focus so much on how to actually engage with government themselves. I don't know that because I haven't been to a high school classroom, so it may be that they're teaching that and the students just aren't seeing the relevance to their life. But what I find is that when they come into my class, they're quickly realizing that this applies to them and that they should probably learn a little bit about what their job is as a citizen.
The level of government that can seem most obscure to them is the level of government that's the closest to them, and that's local government.
Absolutely. I mean, I think my students don't really understand until we do some actual engagement with government how much of their life is affected by the most local government. And I will say that it is obscure to them, but part of that is just that it's really, really hard to get information about what's happening with government at a local level, especially for people who don't live in a major city. So the students I have who live in Dunlap or in South Pittsburgh, trying to be a competent and informed citizen in those communities is almost impossible because there's just not local media available to cover that as thoroughly as you would see in, say, Chattanooga.
And even where there is local media, that local media in far too many cases is in jeopardy.
Yeah, I mean, they're stretched so thin. When we have reporters from the local TV stations come to campus to report on something we're doing, they send one person who has to do everything. And it's usually someone who's very young, straight out of journalism school, who's filming, editing, reporting, packaging, and then going on to four or five other sites that day to do it. I was a journalism major, and I worked in media for a short time before I went back to school to get my PhD. And the things that are happening in the media landscape are disturbing in and of themselves. Just how much harder it is for us as citizens to do our part of the civic engagement equation. I think that a lot of what I'm trying to do in my class is equip students with the knowledge of what they need to know and the tools on how to find that.
What can you tell somebody like me about the difference between city and county government here?
They work closely together, but they are two very distinct entities. The most important thing that I try to tell people, either at Chat State or through my Chattery courses, is that the local government, so the city government, has quite a bit of latitude over what they can and can't do, but the county government is largely just an extension of state government. And so they don't get to make a lot of policy. Their primary responsibility is budgeting, really, and awarding contracts for things that are being done in the county, but the city government has a lot more discretion to make policies that will impact people. When you're trying to decide to whom you want to ask a question, it's often really difficult to know where that line is. And it really comes down to, is this something that's being implemented because of a state directive? And if so, you probably want to start with the county. If it's something that's more about what's happening in your community, the city is probably the right place to start.
As we have seen, and we are seeing just in the past week and in the past 6 weeks.
Yes, absolutely.
And then the other civics course that you are teaching at the Chattery online is about the Tennessee legislature. What's something that most people don't know about the legislature?
No matter who I'm talking to, whether it's someone who's in a college class who comes to a workshop or just someone I meet, people don't really have a good sense of how to find out even who represents them. So what the Tennessee legislature is doing is often so opaque to the vast majority of citizens in the state. So I think just understanding what it is and what they're doing is probably the thing most people don't understand. But the Tennessee legislature has pretty broad authority to do a lot. One of the things that I think people don't recognize, though, is that the people who serve in the state legislature, and this is true in most states, but especially in southern states, this is not their full-time job. In fact, it's a pretty poorly paid job. They all have other things that they do, and they're just going to Nashville for maybe 6, 8, 10 weeks a year to do the business of legislating for the state. And so it's often the case that they come into that job not really having a lot of knowledge about what it means to be a state legislator. I can tell you that talking to many of my students and people I know, that people are often really supportive of the idea of term limits for legislators. I've always been skeptical of term limits because it does take a while to learn how to do this job. And if you are term limited, about the time you figure out how to do it, you're out the door. And so I think it's important to understand that these are really complex jobs that people kind of do on the side. They're not making a lot of money. They're not really liked very much by the public at large, and they could do their job better if more people were able to pay attention and communicate with them what they would like to see done on behalf of citizens.
They're not term limited, but they do have a time limit when they meet.
Yes. So the Tennessee Constitution legislates the number of legislative days that the legislature can meet in a two-year period. I want to say it's 90 days. Now, typically the legislature has counted that as days that the floor is in session. So if they're just doing committee meetings to discuss bills that have been proposed, sometimes that doesn't get included. But that's a cap on how much they can get paid, basically. And so typically what they do is in the first year of that two-year cycle, they do a little bit more. In the second year, they'll meet a little bit less because that's going to be an election year. So they want to kind of wrap up things quickly so they can go back to their home districts and work on campaigning and that sort of thing. So they are limited as to how much that they can do in a two-year period. And that really forces the legislature to focus on those things that they feel are most important. So oftentimes when the legislature convenes, you'll hear about a very large number of bills that have been filed. But in reality, a very small percentage of those will even get debated and an even smaller will pass. And so I think sometimes people get a little alarmed at some of the proposals in the bills that are filed, and that's good. You should pay attention, but recognize that the probability that those are going to be enacted is relatively small.
How does the legislature rate when it comes to transparency, and how robust is the media coverage?
I think there are always areas for improvement on this, but in general, I think you can get a good sense of what the day-to-day function of the legislature is. And I will say that, you know, a lot of people feel like the legislature is just this thing that happens and it's out of view. But anybody can walk into the state legislative building and you can just walk into the office of your representative or any representative for that matter. It's open to the public. And so while it can seem very distant and amorphous, it is available to the public. Now, as we've talked about, the ability to follow what's happening depends largely on the amount of media coverage that happens of the legislature. And I think that this is a place where I personally am rather concerned. Our major newspaper in Nashville, the Tennessean, is a Gannett property that continues to have layoffs and layoffs and layoffs. And so the number of people available to cover what's happening at the legislature shrinks every year. And I'm really worried about that. But I think that if you care and you want to pay attention, there are ways to find that information. It just may not be as easy as it once was.
And how do you see the coronavirus pandemic reshaping how the legislature, or for that matter, the city and county, all do their business? Everything from meeting online to facing budget shortfalls.
Because we're in the middle of it, it's hard for me to know exactly what the lasting impact of this will be. But, you know, I'm a state employee. I work for a state community college. And I can tell you that pre-coronavirus, the idea that faculty would be working from home and not coming to campus every day of the work week was completely ludicrous to the idea of how state government works. And now we're not allowed to step foot on campus. So I think that there's definitely a paradigm shift happening. And I think we're all going to have to think really thoughtfully about how we do the business of running state governments in an era where we have to be really careful about how closely we get to other people and how many people are in a space together. But I will say that historically, both the Chattanooga City Government and the Hamilton County Commission have been really good about posting videos, archiving videos, and in some cases audio recordings and transcripts of their meetings online, so that if you really want to pay attention, you can, and it's pretty easy to do. I don't know what it's going to look like for the government to get together as this continues. And one of the things that I'm most interested in is how courts are going to adapt, because historically, most courts have not had the ability to do video conferencing for trials, and especially at the higher levels and especially in the federal system. And I think we're starting to see some of those standard practices change. I don't know if it's going to be for the good or not, but it's really interesting to watch these things that have been in place for so long now have to adapt because of coronavirus.
All right, Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, Elena Nourabadi, Connor Brown, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.